accession number 22155, rail 5.
Martin Bell, rail 5.
And we used to go out from Ljubljana to see what was going on, and had to drive enormous distances to get around these. They blocked most of the main roads with fallen trees to stop the tanks escaping. And there were one or two. The main convoy, I remember, it's my first experience of the Highway of Brotherhood and Unity, which is a great Titoist unifying highway, goes all the way from north and south in the Federation. And we came upon a strong armoured column completely stuck there. And rather nervously, I went forward under a Union Jack, actually, to talk to the colonel in charge. Because there was no Slovenian forces. It was very spooky. And he had at least one badly injured man. So I stopped being a journalist and offered to take this guy to a hospital, which we did. We put him in the back of a car and took him out. And, of course, the Slovenes were happy to look after him. So we did a little bit of good, and I think eventually they did a deal in which they surrendered their weapons and they went off south. But the war was over in about 8 days. The Slovene drive for independence was not resisted. There was no realistic way they could resist it, and they didn't have the political incentive to. Croatia, completely different, maybe 20% Serb-populated, Serbs-controlled very substantial areas, the Krajina especially. And that became a vicious civil war, fought village by village and street by street. And we would sort of venture out. We didn't have any armoured vehicles in those days or body armour or anything. We just went on a wing and a prayer. We'd go out in our vehicles and wait until you got that spooky silence, you know. Talk a lot to the troops on the ground, where you could go, where you couldn't. We were lucky in that, well, I lost a cameraman who was a dear friend of mine, but that was in Bosnia. But this guy did extraordinary things for us in Croatia. The main, looking back on it now, the two main flashpoints were Dubrovnik and Vukovar. Dubrovnik simply because it's so famous, and it got shelled by troops by Serbs from Montenegro, just came up, drove up the road. And that got an enormous amount of press and world attention because Dubrovnik is Dubrovnik. But what happened to Dubrovnik is nothing compared to what happened to Vukovar, this old Austro-Hungarian town on the Danube, which was under Croatian control, and the Serbs decided to take it. And the siege must have lasted for 3 months. And it finally fell on the 17th of or the 18th of November 91. I was back by that time with the Serbs. I don't like being on losing sides. And amazingly, the Serbs let us in. The colonel in charge of public relations in the Serbian army, the JNA, said he'd studied the way the British had controlled the media in the Falklands and decided not to do it like that. And so they signed us a bit of paper. We could go in, we could ask questions, we could go right up to the front. I was there 4 days in a row. And we saw the place fall. It was extremely dangerous. There was an ITN guy there on his first trip to Yugoslavia who got badly wounded on day one because, of course, he didn't realize what he was into. There was not a building left standing. It was terrible. I mean, very high casualties. And we now are pretty sure some executions as well. A lot of Chetniks, that's partisan irregulars, roaming the streets, though I have to say that the Yugoslav National Army was much more disciplined. There was a surrender in a supervised by the Red Cross, and we came in to take pictures of the two sides. It was immediately clear from the opening exchanges that the Red Cross interpreter wasn't up to it, so I lent the Red Cross my interpreter, who's totally fluent in English, Serbian, French, German, speaks passable Japanese as well, and this guy did the translation for them. And they laid down their arms and they walked out. And there was nothing you could ask them. I mean, I was reduced to silence. You couldn't know what. There's nothing you could ask a column of retreating, undefeated troops. It was desperate, desperate times. Absolutely the low point of the war from the Croats' point of view. And, you know, this great city, this river town destroyed for nothing. It made quite an impact locally in the region because our coverage went to television stations everywhere. But as far as Britain was concerned, I suppose in America all that mattered was Dubrovnik, which you had 8 burned buildings and a lot of broken roofs and balustrades. But, you know, relative to Vukovar, it was no big deal. But that was the... And then it all ended, that war... At the lines sort of solidified when winter came, as front lines tend to. And at the end of December, beginning of January, Cyrus Vance was able to broker a peace deal, a ceasefire, with a United Nations force in place. Really to supervise the front lines and so on. And oddly, because Bosnia was already... There were rumors of war in Bosnia. They decided to headquarter this force in Sarajevo. And that led directly to the next war, because by agreeing to the independence of Croatia, which the European community did in December 91, they absolutely ensured that Bosnia would be fought for by its constituent peoples. And I wrote about it in my book. I think it's one of the great scandals of British foreign policy, that the concession to the Germans on the recognition of Croatia, because the Germans really wanted that, was made within 10 days of the German concession to the British on the Maastricht Treaty. So what you're doing, what we did, in my view, for the sake of the convenience of the then ruling party, we signed a nation's death warrant. I think it's one of the most awful chapters in British diplomacy ever. However, the Bosnian War started, I think, on the 6th of April, 92. There was a peace demonstration in Sarajevo, which was shot up allegedly by bodyguards of Radovan Karadzic, the Serbian leader. I mean, I can't say that for sure. I wasn't there. We were 3 days away from the general election of April 92, and the BBC in its wisdom decided it wasn't interested in Sarajevo, so of course I went out late. I got in about the 8th. I was able to drive down with a lot of difficulty from Belgrade, and the whole place just blew apart. It was the most dangerous war I've ever been in. We were based at Ilija, an old hotel near a hot spring in the Serbian-held part of the city. The Serbs were very hospitable to us. And it was a free-for-all down there. And various ceasefires were arranged, fell apart, because, of course, the UN headquarters was there. And this city was fought for street by street, and slowly, amid appalling casualties, the two sides sort of separated out, while in the countryside, the most dreadful atrocities were taking place. I mean, people were being butchered in blood, it was cold blood, they were being shot up in buses, they were being executed in cold blood, women being raped. I mean, it was just... We didn't know all the dreadful things that were happening until some time later. And they were all done by the Serbs. The Serbs struck first. But as the war raged on, and of course it became very complex, a decision was made by the United Nations. The United Nations fled in May 92 because it couldn't sustain its presence. And I regret to say the BBC fled as well. I was out by then, but my successor packed up and quit after 4 days because of mortar fire, which I think was a mistake, because then 2-3 weeks later, I had to come in again. I came in across the airport runway being shot at, so I wasn't very pleased with that decision to withdraw. And we set up again in the PTT building. And then the United Nations came back, led by Canadians from Croatia. And Lou McKenzie was a Canadian general, and we got on very well with him. He did his best to broker ceasefires, to try to get these people to see sense. But it was all to no avail, and it completely fell apart. And it was at that time that the Security Council decided, I think one of the great errors of UN diplomacy, the thing to do, because people were dying, they were starving, that they would use UN troops to escort aid to starving people, which was like, as I wrote somewhere, like passing the food in at the window while the murderer stands at the door. And so, of course, the British got heavily involved. The Cheshire Regiment came out in October 92, based in central Bosnia. And by that time, the war was having repercussions across the whole country. The minority communities in Prijedor, which was mainly Serb-held, so the Croats and Muslims were driven out. And they had really nowhere to go, except they'd been dumped across a front line at Travnik, near the Lesva Valley, which was predominantly Croat. And suddenly these great numbers of Muslims started flooding in, which upset the ethnic balance. And the result of that was a side war between the Croats and the Muslims, which lasted from, April 93 until about February 94. Very vicious. And we spent a lot of our time chronicling that. Also very dangerous. The UN troops would do sort of 6 months at a time. But then, you know, we would trundle along and look at the scenes of these awful massacres. And
are there any, outstanding ones that you remember?
Yeah, it's the Almici massacre is the one that's most remembered because it was the most notorious. It happened in April 93 when a village was, a Muslim village, was set upon by Croats. The minaret was blown up. People were shot trying to escape from their homes or burned alive in their homes. It was premeditated. The UN came upon it 4 or 5 days later, and I was in that convoy, and that's when Colonel Bob Stewart exploded at the HVO Croat commander. And I don't think his superiors in Whitehall were very pleased, but I think it did no harm that
Were you filming that?
Yes, very much so. Well, not personally, but we had a pool cameraman for Nigel Thompson of ITN was doing it. So it was all sort of live on television. Not that day, because we did not at that time have a satellite dish in Vitez, but it was on the next day, and it had a huge impact. It went around the world. Bob's a friend of mine, and I knew he'd gone over the top. I knew that he'd been saying things a bit undiplomatically. And I did. I showed him the videotape afterwards, and actually, it may be unprofessional, but to save his career, I did offer to cut something out if he thought it was important. But no, he said that's how he felt. He wanted it to go out like that. And actually, I mean, I think his career was probably done for anyway, because he's one of these officers who wore his heart on his sleeve and was always more attentive to the soldiers under him than the soldiers over him. He'd deal much better with a corporal than a brigadier. This is not the way to win favour in the army. So, I mean, after that, they gave him one tour of duty in SHAPE headquarters after that, and then he was out. But that's the way the army works. It was very similar. I mean, he probably saved his regiment, which was under threat of amalgamation at the time. It was very similar to what Colonel Colin Mitchell did with the Argyles 20 years before. He lost his career but saved his regiment. The army had trouble with charismatic soldiers. Usually, I mean, Bob Stewart suffered from it, Mitchell suffered from it. The only one I know who's got away with it is, Michael Rose and Arthur Denaro. I'll talk a little bit about
Before you do, Martin, could I ask you a little more about Amici? What was filmed there, and how much of the film was actually shown?
I don't know if the raw tape still exists. I do know that I was well aware of putting that together, which I did the following morning, so we'd just ship out an edited story. I was dealing with some very controversial stuff. Controversial in the sense that the BBC didn't like to upset people. And if you're showing pictures of a family having been burned alive in a cellar, it's upsetting. So, I mean, I took a decision to just show general wide shots, but include there was one very vivid picture of a clenched, burned fist, and I included that to give some indication of what it was like. And I remember the ITN guy. He put too much of the vivid stuff in, and of course he got it hacked about in London because they weren't going to show it like that. The trick was to be able to preempt to some extent what the objections are going to be, and to push the envelope as far as you could, because you can't sit there having an argument. We didn't have any, even much in the way of satellite phones at that time. I couldn't have a daily, I didn't have mobile phones then. So you can't have a daily argument about what shall I show.
Weren't you rather pleased about that?
I was rather pleased about that. I wouldn't like to work in the age of satellite phones, of mobile phones at all.
Mm. Are there any other examples of, you know, for instance, those missile and mortar attack?
There were the two mortar attacks in Sarajevo. I was in central Bosnia. I don't know, I was on my way to the coast when the first one happened in February 94. The second one was at the end of August 95, and I was on the scene for that. And that was the one that provoked the NATO airstrikes. But again, the same problems applied. We were allowed to show very little. I mean, my equivalent of the clenched fist on that second mortar attack was blood swilling down a storm drain. You had to put in something which showed what it was about, other than just wide shots and bodies covered with sheets. Very difficult, very difficult. I think we were hampered by the BBC's guidelines, which were unnecessarily restrictive at the time, and still are, in my view. Or is it an upsetting business?
Were you finding it difficult to convey the complexity of what was going on?
Yes, especially because movement was so restricted. For the last year and a half of the war, we were mainly confined to Sarajevo and a mile and a half of the main street, frankly. Roadblocks up everywhere. But it was very difficult when fighting, shall we say, broke out in Bihać, involving five different forces. There were rebel Muslims loyal to the government, there were Croats, and I think there were two lots of Serbs. It was incredibly difficult. Sometimes I would always give up, because if you can't understand it yourself, you certainly can't explain it to anybody else. That was complex.
Did the fact that you were confined to Sarajevo, where it seemed, from what one gathers, that the Serbs were the main force, you know, they had the power around there, did it mean that perhaps the Serb view wasn't getting reported?
I think that's a fair point. I tried very hard. My own view is that Sonja Karadzic, the so-called president's daughter who ran the International Press Center, did more damage to the Serbian cause than anyone else, including her father, because she just did not understand the need to try and win world opinion over. And of course, because the Serbs started it, they obviously attracted a lot of negative publicity. I mean, it was they who shot other people in buses. It was they who had the rape camps, and so on. And of course, but the negative publicity then played to their paranoia. You know, the whole world's against us, and they were. And from, I'll tell you, from, I said, I can date it exactly, August 94, the Vance Owen plan had been rejected. The so-called contact group came up with something else and a new map, and the Serbs put that to a national referendum of all their people. It was rejected. From that point, we were not allowed to cross that line. And the only international journalists they had were sympathetic Greeks, Bulgarians. I mean, they did it by religion. And they then cut themselves off from the possibility of putting their case to the world outside. And the press corps was driven back into Sarajevo, dependent on Bosnian government sources. And, of course, the result was that the Serbs were unable to put their case in the court of world opinion. They did it to themselves. But I still managed to get over occasionally into Grbavica. I knew a few people there. That is a Serb-held suburb. I think my colleagues in the Sarajevo press corps suspected me of being faintly pro-Serb because I didn't denounce them uphill and downdale on all occasions. And I still insist there was no monopoly of wrongdoing and no monopoly of evil in those wars. And Serbs were massacred. One of the arguments I had was the BBC very early on. There was an exchange of hostages, very high-ranking hostages. Alija Izetbegović was captured by the Serbs as he came back from an international conference at the airport. The JNA general in the main barracks in town was essentially a hostage. So a deal was done in which the UN would bring out the general and escort Izetbegović down. At some point, there would be a handover. Fine. the two big men were handed over, and then the Muslims, the Bosnian forces, cut the column and they massacred a number of Serbs inside an army ambulance. And I had difficulty persuading my people in London that Serbs were also the victims of massacres. That was Department of Preconceived Notions, you see. There was a very severe massacre of Serbs at a place called Bratunac in eastern Bosnia, January the 7th, 93, which led directly to the Srebrenica massacre of July, 2.5 years later, because the people of Bratunac, the Serbs, held the Muslims of Srebrenica collectively responsible for that massacre. And there was no way when they got them, when they rolled into the UN safe area, that they save these people. In fact, the Dutch ran away. It was a disgraceful episode. And when I said so on Newsnight, I got a very angry letter from the Dutch Defence Ministry. However, I think the Dutch now accept that they did not behave honourably in that matter. Interestingly, it was a conscript army. They didn't have the morale to hold out in a siege situation. The British, different battalions, had exactly similar number of people in Gorazde. They came out of it stronger than they went in. It was a professional army, and they know how to do the business. And they lost some people taken hostage in 95, but that was the only serious mishap. So we learned a lot about the different armies. And from about 94, after side war between Muslims and Croats was over in central Bosnia, and in Mostar. I spent some time in Mostar, which was a dreadful mess. We were really driven back into Sarajevo, because that's where the efforts to end the war would be centred, and that's where a lot of the most dramatic stuff happened. And we spent a lot of time with the two British commanders, Rose and Smith, really until the war ended in October 95.
Yes, I think you were going to say something more about Michael Rose, weren't you?
Michael Rose is an interesting man. He's a charismatic soldier. He's given his own account of it. We got on all right.
Did you?
Well, we're not closest of friends, but we each used our separate books to criticise the other.
What was it like working with the UN after your recent experience, really, wasn't it, in the Gulf? Being with the army and, being under sort of very heavy censorship, as you've explained.
Well, yeah, so there was no real censorship in the Bosnian war at any time, except the censorship by denial of access. If you're on television, you don't have the pictures, you can't tell the story, and they knew that. So an awful lot of time was spent at the end trying to wangle access, usually unsuccessfully. What the UN was doing, of course, was not really war fighting at that time. It was trying to keep the peace when there was no peace to keep, and working to an absurdly inadequate mandate. And to me, the strength of Rupert Smith was that he came in January 95 and he saw this. And he was not blown about as Michael Rose had been by the crisis of the moment. He was able to get a grip on it. And he initiated a bombing of the Serbs in May 95 because they had seized weapons from weapons collection points where they'd been put under international control. And to punish them, he sanctioned the bombing. But his real reason for sanctioning the bombing was to send a signal to UN headquarters that the UN could not go on as it was. And it was a time to raise the stakes, to be much more muscular, or to get out. And there were many scenarios for withdrawal at that time. Out. And what actually happened was that Smith was able to move the thing along with the bombing of the marketplace in the end of August 95, because by that time there used to be a dual key arrangement in that no NATO bombing would be allowed unless both NATO commander and the UN on the ground sanctioned it. Well, by agreement with New York, the UN's key was taken away from Yasushi Akashi, the
at all costs conciliator, who was the Secretary General's special representative, and handed over to the military, to General Janvier, who was much under Akashi's influence. But at the critical time when this bombing happened, Janvier was at one of his children's weddings in France. So the key passed to Rupert Smith, who just turned it. And from that point on, it couldn't be turned back. And so I think, when all these said and done, I hope very much that Mr. General Smith will confide his memoirs to this archive, because he knows what happened.
Did you have briefings by the UN? And, you know, bearing in mind your experience, going from Slovenia, Croatia, were you sort of, was it a cross-fertilisation of information?
So. Very much so. Before the Cheshire Regiment went out, I lectured them about what they were in for. We and the press had been there before the UN were there. We knew a lot of the main hoods and hoodlums. We stayed there longer. We didn't do just six-month tours of duty. And therefore we had, Michael Rose was, to a significant extent, I think, advised by Kurt Schork, the Reuter correspondent, who took a completely different view of the war from his. I mean, Kurt was very pro-Bosnian government. At one point in Michael Rose's tour of duty, he went to lecture what was then still the Army Staff College of Camberley, and he took Kurt with him to give the opposition point of view. So they were, and I think Christian Amanpour was also quite influential. I mean, I was in the outer office quite a lot. And we also dealt on first name terms as friends with the chief of staff, the military assistant, and especially with the two British Army interpreters who went under the names of Nick Costello and Mike Stanley, which of course were not their real names. So there was a sort of inner core and a lot of ideas going back and forth and information being exchanged. Plus also there were the daily UN briefings, which were interesting sometimes for what they didn't say. And sometimes real information came out. It was not just the UN spokesman would be there, but there would be usually the man from UNHCR and the representative of the International Red Cross as well. So you'd get some of the basic facts of what had gone on.
Were you ever criticised by Michael Rose, your reports?
Oh, yes.
On what grounds would this have been?
I had a big row with him because he went to Garaj Day. And it was then a place we couldn't get into. And there was a videotape of this shot on a uniformed shoulder. A soldier shot it. And Michael Rose was doing his professional soldier bit and saying how easy it would have been for the I've got to get this right, I think it's the Bosnian army to have stopped the Serbs from advancing on the place. Really, it was a crowbar and put a rock on the road. And he put it about the Serbs were not doing a very good job of defending the place. Now, of course, these tapes came to us through army sources. And I said, wow, okay, I'm going to use this. I mean, it came to us on the television station. Somewhere along the line, the message has not got through, certainly to me, that these were placed on some kind of a list we're not allowed to use them. So I was sort of really court-martialed the next day. I'll be sort of made up after that, it embarrassed him with the Muslims, but I said, look, General, at least the Serbs will be talking to you again now. He had a very short fuse. No doubt he still has a very short fuse, Michael. But we've done some things together in civilian life afterwards. I've addressed his officers training corps in Oxford University and shared a platform with him, so I think
Oh, excuse me, Martin.
It was pretty good in a year.
Do you think he achieved much in that year, though? You know, bearing in mind the situation he inherited.
He would disagree with this. I think the situation he left a year later was, if anything, as dire as the one he inherited.